KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Today, the KZSU East Coast Studios, a euphemism for my home in Greensboro, North Carolina, has an in-studio guest. On rare occasions, I've been able to the Skype interview that has become the standard medium for interviews ever since I physically left California in 2007 and bring guests into my home studio. And so today I'm very excited to have on Professor Vance Ricks of Guilford College, author of the recently published article Gossip in the Digital Age, which is an essay and a collection of essays on these topics in a book entitled Social Media and the Value of Truth, published by Lexington Publishers recently. Vance is joining me in the, as I mentioned, the euphemistically called East Coast Studios of KZSU, which is another way of saying my basement studio. So for those of you who have been interested, or perhaps a better word is frustrated by the use of Skype, hopefully you will now hear what a live studio recording might sound like, absent the intensely professional equipment and setup that we have in Palo Alto. Today, Vance is going to be talking about this article, which I think is a perfect topic for Hearsay Culture, given the overlaps in a number of substantive areas that we talk about on Hearsay Culture over, and we have talked about since its inception. Social media, of course, is a topic that we have spent quite a bit of time on this show from a variety of perspectives, from the perspectives ranging from privacy to literally the question of whether teenagers and younger can have the physiological ability to make the right decisions in social media, with guests like Gary Small, to questions relating to how information flows, to the political impact of using social media on topics ranging from the Arab Spring to the elections both in 2012 and in 2008. In Vance's article, he takes a close look at the role of gossip as it's been, as he will define it, and what it means given social media. The nature of gossip, of spreading rumors, of spreading information that may or may not be accurate, of course, is a topic that goes back to the dawn of man. But social media, of course, as we know, has exacerbated not only the ability to spread gossip, but also its impact. And so Vance's article is a very interesting one, because he gets into the questions of what is good gossip, what isn't good gossip, and what social media might say about it. The range of issues that might come up in a gossip scenario, of course, is quite broad. And so part of our discussion today is going to be a question of literally what is gossip today. How is gossip viewed? What is its value? What is it doing that perhaps is beneficial? And so there's a lot here. The focus on this show is not going to be law. Vance's background is not in law. In fact, his background is more on the sociological side and philosophy side, which we're going to talk about. And so I expect that we're going to have a fairly wide-ranging discussion. It may touch on law, but of course I will give the caveat that Vance does not have a JD. By way of that background, Vance is from Charlotte. He graduated from Guilford. He also worked at IBM as a technical writer, and he got his PhD at Stanford in philosophy, writing on the subject of friendship. He has taught at Guilford for a number of years. I got to know Vance through an email that he sent me a few years ago, saying that he listened to the show and asking me, are you actually here in Greensboro? And I was excited to say I was. And so I've gotten to know Vance through email and occasional lunches over the past few years. I should thank him on the air and publicly for his flexibility in scheduling the show. I am thrilled to be recording this show on June 3rd for airing on June 5th. And so it's quite timely. But Vance, I will now turn it over to you, and thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Well, thanks, Dave. And as you said, various fates conspired to keep us apart for the last 4, 5, 6 months, however long it's been. But I'm thrilled to be here finally. And also, to see the studio. One imagines how things look when one's listening to a podcast or a TV show or movie or what have you. But to be in the actual studio and see where the magic happens is a real privilege. Let me also say, as a former Stanford student, during my time there, I had a show on KZSU myself, and so it was a weekly news show called Inside Stanford, and I ran the board, occasionally contributed an interview or a piece. And so for those of you in the Bay Area now and those of you who may someday return there or be there, I want to just put in a plug for KZSU. I think it's a wonderful station. It's been many years since I have been out there or worked with anybody there, but just fantastic folks there.
Well, that's great to hear. And, I think, KZSU's alums are doing a lot of different things. Let me be a little more specific and just ask you a couple of things in light of the fact that these are unusual questions. When were you at Stanford so that the real veterans who are listening will be able to say, oh, yeah, I remember that guy?
That's a good question. Let's see. I believe I started in the fall of 1994 and was there for about 5 years, 5 or 6 years. And it was one of those situations where I got a job before having actually completed the degree. So there's, in terms of my physical presence at Stanford, there's a duration, and then my sort of time to degree is a little bit different.
And so let me ask you this related question. It's a dangerous one. I don't script the questions, as you know, but I think I have a sense of what the answers might look like, but this one I have no idea. So you imagined these palatial studios. And now I've got to ask you, does what you have seen match what you imagined?
It does in some ways, and I think this will be actually a theme that we touch on in the conversation of gossip, that the power of what fairly humble technologies can accomplish, just in making it possible for people to communicate cross-continentally, let alone, from a distance of a few feet away, but then to be able to edit, mix it, make it available in pretty sophisticated ways. I'm surprised and not surprised by what I see, but also encouraged, because again, I think it's been a great time for, podcasting, just to make it clear, to see your studio as an example, that one doesn't have to mortgage one's house in order to be able to get a really nice setup and have these kinds of conversations and make them available to people.
Yeah, and that's, I'll tell you, and that was a fun part of doing this, and I, without diverting too far, because I do want to talk about your piece, and that's the focus today, as I was leaving Stanford in 2007, I started chatting with the audio engineers at Stanford, including Mark Lawrence, who was there when you were there.
Yes.
And Mark is still keeping everything together and doing quite well doing it, and also other audio geeks at KZSU, and talking about what I needed and exactly what you're pointing out. I mean, I envisioned that it might be cost prohibitive for me to pull this off. The mixer that I have here, which is an Alesis, now I'll do a plug for Alesis. It's held up well. I spent about, $300-$400 on it. Probably, the mics, if you throw in a computer, I mean, you're talking a grand. I mean, you're not talking, it's not a small amount of money, but it's doable. And it's been a lot of fun to do, and it's one of the reasons why I continue to do it. And of course, once those costs are, expended, that's it. I mean, I haven't, you don't have to do further investment. Well, okay. I appreciate the plugs both through KZSU and I think indirectly for Hearsay Culture. And as much as I would love to continue talking about me and my studio here and get more praise, let me turn around and actually do what I told the listeners I would be doing. Let's talk about your piece.
Okay.
But I thank you for the compliments. So let me ask you this question. And as a listener of the show, I know you know that this is a standard first question I ask. I very briefly went through your background. Perhaps you could talk a bit more about your background and what the philosophy of technology is, and more broadly, why you focus on it.
Sure. My background, in a nutshell, is that I am someone who is, at least by self-conception, both a sort of philosophy geek and a computery geek. And, I went to Guilford. Guilford did not have a computer science program. But the freshman advisor I had said, well, you may want to get interested in philosophy, because philosophers are doing a lot of work on questions about artificial intelligence and about what computing is, and so that may be a direction that appeals to you. And it turned out that it was. So I ended up, while in college, spending pretty much every summer in the Research Triangle Park at IBM, working out there, doing technical writing and programming. And, obviously, Stanford was a very hospitable place for people with interest in technology, and so I got to soak up a lot of great geekdom while I was out there. And when returning to Guilford as somebody on the other side of the desk, I resurrected a course that hadn't been taught in many, many years, a course on computer ethics. And I've been teaching that course at least once a year for the past decade now, and this semester, or this summer term, I'm teaching a related course called Virtual Selves, which is about identity and community online. So in terms of what the philosophy of tech is, there are a lot of different ways to answer the question, but I guess the it's an umbrella category that focuses on what technological devices do for us and to us, both as individuals and as members of societies. It's raising questions about, not to sound too portentous, but in some ways about what it means to be human. When we think about things like technological enhancements, or we think about even basic tools like writing or the wheel, and the ways in which they shape and are shaped by, you know, human norms, human cultures.
So that gets into this more specific question, right? And perhaps we can contextualize your essay by you describing a little bit the context of the book to which this is contributed. So tell us a little bit about the book, which has come out, Social Media and the Value of Truth, and where your essay fits into the broader themes that book, this collection of essays, seeks to expand upon.
Well, to me, it's an exciting collection, not least because it's nice to be published, but also because it's a truly multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary collaboration. Collaboration may be too strong a term, because we didn't actually all sit down together, and in fact, some of the other contributors are people that I know only through email. But there are folks who teach or have backgrounds in media studies or sociology or psychology, philosophy in my case, communications, I said already, I think, but, computer science. So the range of issues really is narrow, honestly, but it's a set of issues that are approached in a multidisciplinary way. So what does it mean to think about truth from the perspective of someone in media studies or someone who's teaching a journalism course? What is a good way to characterize social media in the first place if you are coming from a computer science background, let's say? So the range of chapters tries to look at both of those ideas, the notion of social media itself, the ways in which it's used, how those things both bear on getting at truth, or whether truth is even part of the equation in the first place when it comes to our behavior, our interactions with each other through social media.
When we think that gossip is morally neutral, mm-hmm. And so let's start there before we even defend gossip as a morally neutral concept.
Great. So I want to lying in her book on secrecy. There's a chapter in the book on secrets about gossip, and we talked about that as a class. It's been many years. I was looking through my notes a couple of years back and thinking, I wonder what, if anything, an updated version of this chapter might look like. So now let me go back and answer your actual question. I think, at least in my own case, gossip as a concept faced an uphill battle, and it was in part my reading of Bach's work that shifted my thinking a little bit on the subject. Because I think, first of all, gossip is generally associated with running people down, with a sort of unvirtuous Schadenfreude. Maybe that's a redundant phrase. The other thing I think is that there's a gendered component to gossip, where it's often thought of as the sort of trivial clucking of women about things that are not important, unlike the kinds of things that men talk about, which are not considered gossip. So I think those tend to be many of the dominant reasons that that gossip has a bad reputation. So in characterizing it as morally neutral, what I'm trying to do is to pull apart a couple of things. One, what kind of information is gossip that's distinct from, I was listening to the news on the way over here this morning. Is that a form of gossip to be talking about events that are going on in the world or things that world leaders are doing? And second, to think about what are people's motives for conveying certain kinds of information and conveying it to certain audiences. So I want to leave room, in other words, for the possibility that when we zoom in on those different pieces, that we can see that there can be contexts in which those things can occur for morally good reasons or for morally bad ones.
And so that leads to the question of what we define as gossip. So this is your standard academic question. What is it?
Right. And so I want to avoid the standard philosopher's project, which tends to be, and no disparagement or disrespect meant to any once or future philosophers in the audience, but I think it's our go-to move is to try to isolate necessary and sufficient conditions for things and then erect all kinds of puzzles that arise when we discover that the necessary conditions are neither necessary and the sufficient ones aren't sufficient either. So what I'm going to offer a kind of prototype characterization, and it turns out as we go through our conversation that I'll and you also will find ways in which it's inadequate. but it's at least, I think, a useful starting point. So the first thing I want to say about gossip is that the prototype cases involve more than one person having a conversation about some other person or maybe group of people who are not there, who are not present. And that the subject or content of the conversation usually is about what we would call personal information or facts about that absent person or people. And so again, that's a multi-part sort of characterization, each of which I think could be independently scrutinized and found wanting, but I think that will at least get us started.
So we're chatting with Professor Vance Ricks of Guilford College. I should have mentioned you have either the benefit or the burden of being chair of your department as well. I should have known that in the introduction. So let's go a little deeper. You had, and it's interesting, you mentioned Cecilia Bach, and, as I began to explore secrecy and commercial secrecy several years ago, I immediately, of course, went into her work. Tell us a bit more about those conversations, because it's something that you mentioned, and I think it's useful, particularly to contextualize what you're doing. And I think really the first question has to be, for those who aren't familiar, who is Cecilia Bach, and how her, those conversations themselves influence the work you do.
So she is a moral philosopher, and I guess that's an ambiguous term, but I mean it perhaps in both senses, but a professor of moral philosophy who has written, teaches at Harvard, among other places, has been there for many years, but has written about what we in the field, I guess, would call social philosophy, which is, in other words, thinking about normative questions and their application to the elements of social life. So her approach to problems, I would suppose you would say, is more practical, and I know I will get into hot water for characterizing it that way, but I think, for instance, that a book on secrets, a book on lies, those are each books that address directly issues that we all face daily, and described. She describes the issues and surveys a range of views in ways that I think are very humane but also very rigorous. So the question you asked me also was about my conversations with her.
Yes.
So really my conversation went like this. Hello, Professor Bach. We've never met, and I'm sending you an email from out of the blue, but I had a couple of questions about your chapter on gossip and wondered whether you could take, some time to answer them. So she was very kind and wrote back, and over the course of a couple of weeks worth of email conversations, what I tried to articulate and what she helped me articulate was, okay, given the way that you are describing gossip in your book, are there aspects of our contemporary life that you think may need to be reimagined, or are there aspects of your conception of gossip itself that you think may need to be reimagined? Because, again, as I mentioned, the book came out in 1970s, and there was something like an internet back then, but in no way does it resemble what we now call the internet. And so it occurred to me that perhaps the ability to have conversations, the nature of the conversations, the audience for those conversations are all things that may look, the landscape in general may just look very different now, 40 years on, than it would have back then. And, how would you, as somebody who wrote a seminal work on this topic, reconceive what you wrote, if at all. Yeah, go ahead.
And I was going to say, you made a point of this, and I think I want to emphasize it. And this is really a question aimed at academics, and putative academics in the audience. The notion of sending an email right, to a, you know, leading person in your field out of the blue saying, hi, I'm someone who you don't know and you wouldn't have any reason to know, but I want to engage you in a critical discourse, not only about your work, but about mine. Seems like a daunting one. And yet my experience is that people, again, regardless of the discipline, I mean, you know, I'm an attorney and I teach law. Your background is very different, but we share this mutual interest. I found that people that are successful in the field have that kind of audacity. And so putting aside gossip, but really focusing on, again, the inside baseball for academics, reaction. I mean, what's your experience in doing that and what advice would you give on that front? And it's a diversion, but I think it's an important one.
Well, thank you for asking, and that gives me a chance also to sing more of her praises, because I honestly had no idea what I was doing. I mean, it was one of those actions I took and later thought, what possessed you to do that? And I tried to be as, I don't want to say self-effacing as possible, but certainly to say, as you pointed out, you don't know me, you have no reason to know me. I've taught a book, taught a course using your book, and so that's the way that I feel a tenuous connection to you, and I know that you're probably busy. I don't even know whether you read email, but in any case, if you do, here's some thoughts that I've had and questions. The other thing I did was to say, I really think you, Professor Bach, have staked out this territory, and so I am asking in some way a kind of permission slash blessing if I wanted to explore this. Are you working on it now currently? Because I don't want, you know, if you have something that's about to come out or that's in the pipeline, I obviously want to wait and see what that is and get to read it and digest it. If you don't, would you mind if other people carried that ball? And the only response she had to that specific concern of mine was, just make it clear that you are expressing your views, not mine. You know, that it's fine to say, this conversation was inspired by talks with Professor Bach, but is in no way necessarily, you know, it doesn't speak for her, right? Mm-hmm. My writing speaks for me, at least on a good day, and that it's not in any way, I suppose one could call it Bachian, but it, you know, it doesn't have her imprimatur or endorsement. So in other words, by trying to say, yes, I acknowledge my debt to you, and I think the field acknowledges its debt to you, and that's why you should have first dibs, as it were, on updating what you wrote if you want to, or not even thinking what I did was updating it, but rather just revisiting the topic. Mm-hmm. And so I think perhaps rhetorically, and it sounds very calculating when I describe it that way. I didn't mean for it to be, but I think that probably didn't hurt either.
Well, you know, and it's, I mean, again, I think it's an interesting diversion. You know, the notion of staking out claims can be a very defensive one. You know, mm-hmm. I need to be the only person who writes in this space or makes this point or goes in the area. I write in the area of trade secrecy, which is a very narrow field, even within IP, much less in law. And so I'm pretty confident in saying that I know every academic, at least in the United States, who's writing about trade secrecy. And yet, right, there might be another person writing about my aspect of it, and dealing with that reality is one that I mean, on a personal level, I think it's great. In fact, I want more people writing these areas, but that's not always the view.
Right.
So it's nice that you got that reaction when it could have been, and you could, you know, you don't have to speculate as to what your action would have been. Yeah, thanks for asking, and I'd really prefer if you avoided stepping on my feet, in which case perhaps your career goes a different direction.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So it's an admirable move, but a high-risk one as well. Again, we're chatting with Professor Vance Ricks of Guilford College on KTSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Vance, let me before we take a break, again, I'll ask you the last kind of setup question, if you will, before we get into the depths of the essay. So, and you know, you have a PhD, so I can ask this one. Your thesis. If you were to crystallize now, and I'm asking you to do it in about 2 minutes, crystallize your thesis here, what is it?
My thesis in the chapter, the article, is that yes, I do believe that whatever earlier notions people may have had about how to think about gossip need to be revisited and perhaps revised in the light of some what I think of are kind of elemental aspects of the communications technology infused societies that we live in now. So at bottom, I think it offers us an opportunity to maybe support my thesis, again, of the moral neutrality of gossip. But I also think that it raises questions about the very definition of gossip that we'll return to, particularly the one that I find most vexing. Can one gossip about oneself? And also, what sort of agency is implied by the term gossip? So the notion of frictionless sharing being something that we'll probably revisit after the break. So I tried to be succinct in stating my thesis. I guess the bottom line is, yes, I do think that these new times that we live in call for a reconceptualization of gossip.
We're chatting with Professor Vance Ricks of Guilford College on KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the show. So, Vance, let's start off here with, I think, a question that allows us to now get a little more in-depth in your essay. You talked about it a little before, but let's define this a little more clearly. Rumor mongering is something that we think of as gossip. You mentioned gossiping about oneself, which I think is an interesting question I want to get to. But let's draw a bright line. What's the difference between gossiping and rumor mongering?
To me, this goes back to looking closely at people's intentions and states of mind. I don't want to insist necessarily on a hard and fast division between those things, but at least in my mind, the difference really boils down to how important is accuracy to the person conveying the information. So I think of, I don't know whether this word will be bleeped out, but Harry Frankfurt's book, you know, derived from his essay on bullshit. And one of the things he says is characteristic of the bullshitter, as he defines it, is that the attitude that person takes towards what they're saying is that of basic indifference. They don't care whether what they're saying is true or false. It's not even that they're trying to deceive. It's that they don't care. And so I think of rumor mongering as closer to that end of the spectrum, that someone can monger a rumor or spread a rumor without necessarily being at all interested in verifying it or even wondering how it might be verified. For me, gossip implies at least some concern for accuracy about what one is conveying. Again, you may take minimal steps to find out whether what you're saying is accurate, but it's more about your attitude towards what you're saying.
And so, yeah, we'll choose to maybe say bull S.
Okay.
In the interest of not offending others, and I'll go back and think clearly about whether I need to bleep anything. But we're having an academic discussion. So, all right. So if we're talking about behavior, which itself is in some sense done for reasons other than getting a reaction, mm-hmm. right? And i.e. I don't care because I'm going to say it regardless of what you think. Isn't that at the core of communication, particularly in social media, where people are, and again, this is kind of the pivot, right? Where people are presenting themselves in a way that they choose to be seen as opposed to reflecting what's going on in everyday life.
Yes, I agree with that. I think, and this goes back to the case for the moral neutrality of gossip is primarily, I think, primarily rests on the fact that we're primates, right? We are social beings. We get valuable information about ourselves and about each other by engaging in this practice of what's called gossip. If you have a horrible experience with your auto mechanic, it can be useful for the rest of us to know about that. And it may be expressed in terms that are condemnatory, but that serves a social benefit, you know, to your friends and family. Likewise, when we write letters of recommendations for people, that perhaps could be seen as a form of gossip that's also, again, part and parcel of, what it means to be a social being. So going back to social media and the idea that we are engaged in some kinds of what I call in the paper self-curation and self-presentation. So it sounds like your challenge to me is, well, doesn't that reflect a maybe indifference towards accuracy or towards getting it right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a challenge for my view. I have thought about that as Well, if I'm selecting the photos that I upload so that they're only the most flattering, if I'm posting only the most amazing and awesome achievements or, you know, descriptions of my awesome meals or whatever it is that's going on in my life, is that not itself a form of indifference to the truth? I can certainly see the case for that. I think a selective portrayal of oneself, let's say, or one's characteristics is, you know, a form of, I don't know whether dishonesty is too strong a term, but it's clearly a form of curation. It's a form of selectiveness. That said, I do think it's different from creating out of whole cloth. You know, if I use GIMP, the wonderful open source software tool, right, yeah, to, you know, superimpose my head on someone else's body as they're hitting a home run, again, that I think might reflect a kind of indifference to accuracy. Whereas even the person who's being very selective about what they disclose online still cares about a kind of accuracy, I think, or at least can. Just they have a very narrow conception of what it is.
Yeah, and when you ingress social media onto this, I think, you know, the question that comes to mind when you ingress social media is the impact of gossip exacerbated? But of course, if we remove social media, then your audience is smaller anyway. Right. And so I guess I'll ask the question that way. Are all of the positives and negatives of gossip amplified by virtue of social media, or are we just dealing with simply a question of scope? In other words, the impact is the same, it's just that more people might hear it.
There are two things I want to say about that. The first is that I agree that in a, you know, sort of pre-electronic age, let's say, people tended to live less mobile lives more generally, and so the effects, both for good and for ill, of gossip were in some ways, I think, amplified in ways that they may not be today, because one, you know, lives in a small community, having a bad opinion of someone else in that community could really damage their ability to earn a living or to have good social relations with other people. So in some ways, broadening the audience both increases the number of people who can condemn what you're doing or praise what you're doing, but it may also have the effect of making it easier for you to find other people who are sympathetic to your norms or who approve of what you're doing. And so that raises the second point, which is that some of the folks that I read while I was working on this article and thinking about gossip generally have pointed out that gossip plays a policing role, both in as much as we are gossiping about people usually because they are violating some norm that we think they shouldn't have violated, but that can itself be a way for people to challenge norms, that one can say, well, I'm doing this, or I'm living this sort of life, or I'm interacting in this sort of way, but that the fact that other people are condemning me may say more about them than it does about me. So it may open a space, in other words, to challenge or critique certain norms that people have. So in the long run, yes, I do think that it may be one of those cases where a difference in degree becomes a difference in kind. I don't know.
Yeah, and these are somewhat abstract questions. And again, we're chatting with Professor Vance Ricks of Guilford College, author of the essay Gossip in the Digital Age, which has been recently published by Lexington Publishers in the book Social Media and the Value of Truth. Perhaps we can get at that question, Vance, by getting into the way that you structure the analysis. When we think about the digital age, and perhaps this is a question that, you know, I should have asked sooner, you identify three characteristics of them. What are the three characteristics, and how did you choose them?
Okay, so now I get into the pointy-headed language.
Yes,
so
yes.
the terminology that I use is not maybe this is fortunate, maybe it's not unfortunate, but it's not unique to me. But so the aspects are what I call hypertrophic attention economies. The second is context collapse, related to another notion of radical transparency. And then the third is a sort of semi-intentional propagation of personal information. So these, I think, are things that, again, aren't necessarily unique to the digital age, but I think are characteristic of it. So hypertrophic attention economies basically means that we are as we always have been, trading in the currency of reputation as much as we trade in other currencies, and that we now have far more opportunities. And let me back up and say, by we, I'm primarily addressing and thinking about the kinds of people who would be interested in a podcast like this and able to think about and experience the kinds of technologies that we take for granted. So I don't know whether this is a statement about the human race, but for those of us to whom this is applied, I think that what it means is, in part, we have a whole lot of different channels now communicating with us and channels that are competing for our attention. So in as much as we think of attention as a sort of resource, we face more and more demands for our attention. We face more and more people, more and more technologies, more and more social tools that are asking for our attention. You know, join this account or become part of this network or use this device to communicate with various people about various things. So that requires that we be more selective, I guess, about what we're going to pay attention to. And the flip side of that is that we have to be more selective and I think more strategic about how we're going to attract other people's attention in the first place and keep their attention. So that's the hypertrophic attention economy.
I think it would be useful because I can double back on a few questions.
Okay. So the second sort of paired notions are those of context collapse and the sort of push for radical transparency. So the one way of getting at context collapse that I usually use with students in my classes that they get right away is that weird sensation when you're out at the movie and you see me also at the movie theater. Okay. And how strange that is that, oh, first of all, I thought you just went back into refrigerated storage in between class. You know, I'm surprised, Vance, that you exist off the campus. But also it's kind of creepy that my instructor is somebody who likes to watch Iron Man. It's all wrong, right? Yeah. You know, there's my entertainment world and there's my school world and they should not combine. Or, you know, maybe, you and I are just, because of our jobs, you know, coming off the ends of semesters and we've been through commencement ceremonies and, you know, when your student meets, or you meet one of your students' families for the first time or they meet their child's instructors for the first time and they're wanting to tell you embarrassing stories about things their child did as a 7-year-old, and you're thinking of this person as somebody in their early 20s, mid-20s. And so, again, there's what I call the collapse of context, and others, Dana Boyd, most prominently, for instance, uses this phrase. So, again, the idea is that things that are in different contexts and normally coexist very happily in those different contexts combine in a way where everything is now just one context. So that's connected to a notion that some people have called radical transparency, where they say, no, it's not a bad thing that happens. It's actually a good thing, because their argument is we should not have different contexts if that implies that we are different people in those contexts, that the you that interacts with your parents should be the same you who interacts with your buddies, who interacts with your coworkers, who interacts with, you know, the auto mechanic, to go back to that example. And that there's a failure of authenticity, this argument goes, if you display different aspects of yourself or conceal different aspects of yourself depending on the context that you're in. So the argument is not just it's occurring by design. So Mark Zuckerberg most, you know, prominently has talked about this in terms of a lack of integrity, that you should not be able to have multiple Facebook accounts or you should not be able to use pseudonyms, right? That the you who is on Facebook should be the same face that's presented to everyone in your social world. And then the third element is the what I call semi-intentional propagation of personal information. And again, that means just basically that we are both on purpose and not entirely on purpose revealing things about ourselves, personal information, through the devices that we use and the sites that we visit and the tools that we make use of online.
So is gossip all about presentation?
As opposed to
anything other than what, in light of what you're saying, another's reaction to it is. Because earlier you said that a part of gossip, right, is the notion that I'm going to say it regardless of your reaction. And yet everything, unless I'm misunderstanding, everything you're talking about depends on how others will react to it. And so while one could intentionally ignore how others will react, yet they still know there will be a reaction. Mm-hmm. And isn't that the point? So, yeah, it sounds like perhaps I'm being circular, but I'll ask the question that way.
There is what you're probably familiar with, a phenomenon of the humble brag. Mm-hmm. And that, I suppose, excuse me, goes back to the question that I said I was already raising as I set out the prototypical characterization of gossip. That, okay, does it first of all have to involve other people than oneself? And second, does it have to be, you know, so then by definition it's not someone who's absent. So in the case of the humble brag, what one is doing is both asserting a certain norm or standard that you claim to be falling short of, while in reality showing how you exceed that standard or are more wedded to that norm than anyone in your audience could possibly be. And so yes, I think that there are certainly ways of revealing personal information that are meant to show that, yeah, I'm doing good. I'm doing well. So I'm thinking about I'm a sort of avid bicyclist, and there's an app that I use called Strava, which is connected to a website, and you can register for accounts. And so one of the things you do on Strava is, you know, you have your cycle computer, your GPS, and you go for a ride, and then afterwards you can upload the information, and it'll show the map of the route that you took, and how many miles, and how many, you know, calories you burn, and what your average pace was, and so forth. And so why would I want to share that with everyone except to say, hey, aren't I great? Look how many kilometers or miles I rode this week. I bet you didn't get to ride that much, or you didn't do it as fast as I did, or you didn't burn as many calories as I did. And so whether that counts as a form of gossip about oneself, I mean, I think it could fit into the framework that I've offered, because, again, you're holding yourself up. You're saying, here's a certain set of norms, and you're saying, look how I measure up to those norms, or my behavior measures up to that norms, and praise me for it.
We're chatting with Professor Vance Ricks of Guilford College at KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Vance, I'm now getting close to the point of the show where I, as you know, I call the unfair questions portion of the show.
Yes.
Where I started, particularly when I'm speaking to PhDs, where it really is particularly unfair because I'm trying to box you in. The lawyers tend to sometimes handle this better, and then others just get, you know, just are thrown off. So I'm going to ask you unfair questions anyway. And I'm going to come back to something you raised earlier, which I also think is fascinating, which I now think is the appropriate time to discuss it, which is this notion of gossiping about oneself. When I read your essay, I was thinking, well, isn't this just narcissism? Mm-hmm. And yet you use the phrases self-curation and self-presentation. So perhaps I'll ask the question that way. I'm assuming it is possible to gossip about oneself. It seems like you're suggesting that it is. But why isn't this just what we've always called narcissism?
Yes. So not only am I not a lawyer, but I'm not a licensed psychotherapist or any kind of psychotherapist for that matter. But I have sat with that question for the last 4 months since you first raised it. And I have no idea that my initial answer is any worse than anything that I would say now. So I'll just go with that. So, again, I want to go back to states of mind, but I do also want to suggest that so when I think of narcissism, I think of perhaps lack of concern for other people and a lack of interest in other people. And I think if gossip shows anything, it's that we are, many of us, intensely interested in each other, in other people. So I think that I have seen, certainly I have Facebook acquaintances, I will call them that, who are quite able to demonstrate and present a lot of information about their own comings and goings, and who evince very little interest in anyone else's. That I would consider definite, again, keeping in mind I'm not licensed to diagnose any of this, but
it, nor am I.
It fits
what
I
out of our depth.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So so it fits what I would think of as narcissism. The difference, I think, between narcissism and self-curation is that one can curate a self who is, in fact, concerned about other people, who is connected to other people, who wants to do right by other people. And I think that you can stress or emphasize those elements of yourself in a way that doesn't simply mean aren't I great, in the way that I think maybe a narcissist orientation might do.
Yeah, so of course, you know, you've proven again that the question, "What do you mean by," is always a good one, because I'm arguably even less qualified to have this conversation than you are, because at least you think in terms of philosophy. I think about regulations and rules and so forth. But you know, my conception of narcissism, I think, focuses more on literally just being self-absorbed, which is, I think, different than the conception of lack of caring.
Right.
But be that as it may, I think you've answered that question. And so let me ask you a related question.
Well, can I add one thing that occurred to me?
Yeah.
The other thing about self-curation, and now I'm thinking about, so kind of earning finally my philosopher's credentials here by referring to Aristotle. So
there you go, yes.
Aristotle, among others, reminds us that selves are as much group projects as they are individual projects. And so he thought about that specifically in the context of friendship, that when we think of friends, they are what he calls another self. So when I think about self-curation, I think of that also as a project that can involve as much contributions from other people as it does contributions from the self, the specific individual in question. And again, I see that as being different from narcissism, simply because of the sort of absorption on one individual. But for me, certainly, my friends' reactions to things I say and do helps me understand myself, and in some sense helps shape the self that I think I am. So I would also add that as a way in which self-curation could be different from narcissism.
And maybe that ties in to this notion of frictionless sharing that you mentioned earlier. You know, you point out, and I think you've defined it already a little bit, how might gossip about ourselves, okay, play into that? In other words, is this another situation where we've got the nightmare scenario that people have been talking about within social media, internet, more broadly? So now that I've asked the question, I think probably a little bit more contextual definition is useful. And what is this effectively, and what does it mean for social media?
So let me back up and just say, for the maybe five people in the audience who haven't heard this idea or this phrase of frictionless sharing, that it refers to the way in which instead of having to state in declarative sentences, for example, I went to such and such place and did such and such, we have devices, we have apps, we have tools that can effectively state those things for us. So, for instance, going back to Strava as the example, once I upload the data from my GPS, I don't have to type and say, today I took a 30-mile route, you know, going through the scenic cornfields, and it was kind of hilly, and here's what the temperature was, right? The device says all that for me. Likewise, you know, for a time, and I think this is still the case on Facebook, if I read an article on one site, Facebook would handily let people know that I had read that article. Or if I had liked a certain book or purchased a certain song on Spotify, right, that could be information that was conveyed without any extra effort on my part. So the idea of friction is that it would take effort to convey that information, and the idea of frictionless is that now it doesn't, right, that just happens.
And so that gets to this question that I think is a good one as we begin to really close our discussion in the last five or so minutes. You know, even if I agree, and I think I do, that all of that these different characteristics that you define are in fact happening, Facebook in particular is always trotted out as the reason for these things happening. And yet, As much as I'll have as much fun as the next person in demonizing Facebook, it's gotta be more than that. So other than Facebook, can you put a finger on what, and I'll let you decide what those things are, applications, social forces, behaviors are driving these characteristics of the digital age other than Facebook itself?
Yeah, certainly. I think it can fit into a framework that I know is already a little dated, but the idea of the Web 2.0 is the idea of, again, that each one of us can be and I hate this phrase, but I'm going to use it anyway, you know, content creator, that each of us can cultivate an audience, not just be an audience or be part of an audience. So I agree absolutely with you that it's not about the evils of MySpace, Friendster, Facebook, or Pinterest, but that those things are in some ways outgrowths of this feature of the fact that both because devices are so much cheaper and storage space is so much cheaper and you know, the amount of technical know-how that it takes to set up a blog, let's say, is you know, the threshold is much lower than any of those things used to be. So I think those things are combining in ways that drive this idea that, you know, we can always be telling on each other and about ourselves through what we're doing online.
And so that really leads me to, and again, I guess this is about the most legal question I'll ask, but, you know, if you are designing a social media platform and you're going to build some basic values into them, in your conception of what gossip is and the fact that it's morally neutral, what should those core values be? And I know that that's obvious. Like I said, these are unfair questions. So I am asking you to answer that question in about 90 seconds.
Okay.
So in 90 seconds, go.
Well, this is a great question because I love thinking about the ways that values infuse technologies. And so, among other things, I would think that, you know, encouraging the users, and we're talking in abstract terms, so I don't even know whether we're talking about apps or sites or what have you, but thinking carefully about the value of truth, thinking carefully about accuracy is important. Thinking about one's audience, so I think whatever ways you could code in some sort of awareness of, okay, here's a potential audience of people you're addressing. Think about that before you convey this information, even if it's about yourself. Some sort of way of encouraging people to reflect on their motives for displaying or relating the information in the first place. But again, also going back to the idea that it may be semi-intentional, that people may be disclosing things or broadcasting things that they didn't mean to or weren't aware of. There's a recent book called LOL OMG, and it's about what people should know, and it's particularly directed at kids and their parents, before they, you know, venture into the online worlds. And so that book, which I'm just beginning to read, you know, stresses a lot of the things that I'm saying now. You know, be mindful of audience, be mindful of tone, be mindful of, your attitude towards accuracy.
Professor Vance Ricks of Guilford College, thank you for joining us today on the show. Again, the essay is Gossip in the Digital Age. The collection of essays is entitled Social Media and the Value of Truth from Lexington Publishers. Thank you so much for joining us again in the East Coast studios of KZSU, for listening to the show, but most importantly for sharing this work with us. And I should ask you, for those that want to learn more about your work, do you have any recommendations of where they can go?
Well, right now, my website presence is, again, another ugly phrase, is fairly limited, but I do have a Facebook account, and I also am on Twitter, so Twitter might actually be a good way to engage me. It's just at Ricksva, R-I-C-K-S-V-A. People can also email me at my work account, vricks@guilford.edu.
Vance, thanks for joining us today on the show.
Thank you, and I wish somehow that we could cram 2 hours worth of time into an hour's worth of space.
Well, I'll tell you what, I make the offer to most of my guests to come back. Now, I will say that I've had a few people back, but I certainly invite you back, to continue this discussion because clearly, gossip will continue to be an issue. But more, I think even beyond that, the next platform that allows this discussion will be, I think, a good time to continue. So, So let's do that.
Well, thank you. This has been great.
A pleasure.
I hope for the audience as well.
Yes. I am confident in that fact. Well, this is the last show for this quarter on KZSU's schedule. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that I do not do new shows during KZSU's interim. As much as I would enjoy doing those shows, given the fact that at least as of now, my career and where my bills are paid is not heavily focused on hearsay culture, although I enjoy it tremendously and I will continue to do it. I take a break during interim. However, what happens during interim is I also set my schedule for the following quarter. The KZSU schedule will resume towards the end of June, and I'm booking guests. I've got many already booked, but I'm still booking. Among the guests that will be coming on for the summer quarter of KZSU will be Ellen Broad, the Executive Officer of the Australian Digital Alliance, Susan Chalmers, the Policy Lead for Internet New Zealand, Ron Epstein, CEO of Epicenter IP Group, discussing patent non-practicing entities, which are pejoratively known as patent trolls, Professor Phil Napoli of Fordham University on algorithms in media, Professor Devin Desai of Thomas Jefferson Law School on 3D printing, Professor James Moliterno of Washington and Lee School of Law and Technology and Legal Education, Lucevice van der Laan on technology and promoting democracy, my colleague at Elon, Professor Mike Rich of Elon, on criminal acts and technologies designed to limit them, and I'm going to be booking a few other people as well. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to the show. You can listen live this quarter, although this time may change next quarter, at 9 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays, by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu or listening the old-fashioned way in the Bay Area. The show is also available via podcast by going either to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 180-plus shows plus the upcoming guests. You can get the show by going to the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School's iTunes page, or you can go to the webpage for CIS, which is cyberlaw.stanford.edu. I also, and I try to do this every quarter, although sometimes I'm remiss in doing it, which is my fault, but I always want to thank the Born engineers who are take the time to put the show on the air, as I am physically about 3,000 miles away. I also want to thank Elaine Adolfo of CIS, who has taken over the role from Joe Nito of posting the show as a podcast. I appreciate her efforts as well. And I look forward to chatting with you in a few weeks. So in the interim, please feel free to email me with comments, suggestions, or feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Vance mentioned, and I'll remind people, I also have a Twitter presence at hearsayculture.com, quite original. There is a Facebook page as well for Hearsay Culture, although quite frankly, I don't spend as much time with it, but you're welcome to follow the show there. So thanks again for listening to the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.